This was part one of our discussion with Sebastian Bay. We look forward to you joining us next episode for part two.
The first thing we ask our sponsors at CNA when we design games for them, at whatever echelon, is what are the decisions that you want your players to wrestle with?
Greetings, and welcome to the Operational Arch, the official podcast of the School of Advanced Military Studies, dedicated to bridging the gap between tactics and strategy through the study of operational art and the operational level of the war. I'm Major Dan Warner, here alongside Majors Kelsey Kurtz and Josh Bedingfield. We'll be your host today. Our guest today is Sebastian Bay, an adjunct assistant professor at Georgetown University's Center for Strategic Studies, where he teaches a graduate course, Basics of Wargaming, where students learn and research game design and educational war games. He serves as the co-chair of the Military Operation Research Society Moore's Wargaming Community of Practice, and his professional work focuses on wargaming, emerging technologies, future wargaming, future warfighting concepts, and strategy and doctrine for the U.S. Army and Marine Corps. Previously, he served 6 years in the Marine Corps Infantry and deployed to Iraq in 2009. He is the developer of the game Littoral Commander Indo-Pacific, and his writings have been published in Foreign Policy, War on the Rocks, Strategy Bridge, Task and Purpose, The Diplomat, and Georgetown Security Studies Review. Welcome, Sebastian, to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
All right, so a little kind of backdrop here. So wargaming in the United States Army and in joint doctrine, it has a place. It typically aligns with the Army's military decision-making process and or the joint planning process through course of action analysis. And verbatim from JPP, wargaming identifies force requirements and training in preparation for the most likely operational requirements and enables rapid comparison of the hypothetical conditions, operational phase, mission, and force requirements of existing contingency plans to the actual requirements of an emergent crisis. All right, that's a lot of words that kind of describe something that I know a lot of staffs, especially at the battalion and the brigade level, just kind of accelerate through. So I think there's a lot here we can sink our teeth in. And especially for our first topic, wargaming as an educational tool. Maybe we could talk about this idea of using wargame to present a future world or a hypothetical scenario for people to have an iterative process to go through and make rapid decisions. Rather than, you know, wargaming as an abstraction or a calculation of combat outcomes. Because I feel like, especially in the military, when we wargame plans, there's this negative focus into, hey, that wouldn't happen that way. Or, you know, we try to dial into it being a simulation rather than a way to express the ideas and have that clash against competing ideas.
First off, I will say that I personally dislike how wargaming is used in the COA process. It follows the COA development process currently, and I think that is too late in the process to actually have wargaming be useful. On top of that, in practice, during the COA wargaming portion, it is already like a checkmark exercise because so much of the actual effort is done in like mission analysis and COA development that like wargaming is just like, oh, we did it, check. Let's move on to the next thing to get this signed or approved or to the commander. So it's already in the bad spot, and then it's already in use and practically underutilized and misused, right? So if it was up to me, you know what I mean, I would put wargaming before code development. So after you do mission analysis and you understand the problem, you're like, hey, let's wargame this problem out to see what we are going to encounter and what possible futures we will encounter. Do COA development being informed by that wargaming session, and then test and explore the rigor and resiliency of your plans, right, through another session of wargaming. And each of those have different types of wargaming. In the first part, it's very exploratory, open-ended, sort of what you said, like, hey, let's see what's out there, see how these dynamic interactions work. And the second portion really is like, hey, we have developed this plan after wargaming the first time, and we want to see how well our plan adapts, reacts, and is resilient to bends and breaks and pressure points by adversary red team, right, or red cell. So that's how I would change it. But that also requires, one, like, you do it properly. Two, you have the skill set on your staff to do it that way. But in an ideal world, that's how I would, you know, rewrite the joint pub. The other portion about it is there's a core tension when we use wargaming and plan and the planning process, which is like what you just said, Dan, where there's this innate desire by planners to be like, oh, that won't happen, or this won't happen, or like this is will definitely happen, right? But then also as planners, the first, like, you know what I mean, maxim is like no plan survives contact with the enemy, right? But like those are two very dissonant things, right? Like either you know what's gonna happen and hence you're arguing with me about this war game, or you don't know what's happening and you have to bake in resiliency in your plan, right? So planners have this, like, you know what I mean, cognitive dissonance, which I think serves them poorly in the sense of like, hey, the war game is not about predicting the future or predicting a particular outcome. It's saying if this happened, right, if your platoon is blah, 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 right, what would you do, right? It is about the decisions and you reacting to consequences and engaging an active and adaptive mind on the other side who's trying to mess you up at every step of your plan, right? And if you have to argue about, you know what I mean, combat result tables and all that stuff, that means you are hiding behind a poor plan and trying to argue the system, right? And not the content of a game.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely spot on. Our seminar advisor, Colonel Horgan, you know, was dropping these knowledge bombs on us earlier in the year, saying the same thing, right? Like, the wargaming doesn't start when co-analysis, right? Like, when I go to my car, I wargame whether or not I'm going to get to my destination on time based on the bus schedule of the post, right? There's like an internal if-then clause going on for my actions. And we kind of center it, and it's this focused, distinct thing that only looks like one thing. And I think we lose a lot of the utility, like you said, out of it, right? And it's way too late, you know, to change plans, especially like if we're, I don't know if we necessarily agree that complexity theory is a thing in the military decision-making process. I feel like it's adverse to it, but if we're initial conditions is going to give you the variance that you need to account for in your plan, there is not a lot of time to actually sit down and have a thoughtful discussion about what's the initial set look like before execution, so you can try to make an adaptive plan.
Yes, and I think there are a bunch of assumptions in the COA development process, which we as planners and analysts need to dissect more. Like, we always say, like, hey, what is the worst probable course of action? What is the most likely, right? But those are risk assessments that we do based on intelligence, right? But there is a certain level of bias, right, that we bake in culturally, normally, organizationally, and so forth, right? And with the resident knowledge on a staff, right? So a Navy staff will think of COAs differently than a Marine Corps staff or Army staff, right? But the question really is how is our adversary thinking? And the reason that I say you should have two wargaming sessions in the beginning and the end is that by the second time you wargame and you have a code after code development, your red team should be smarter and like, hey, we won or lost the first time in the first COA development game this way. So let's try to think of something different, right? So you want to see how your adversary is going to adapt, because we should never assume our adversaries are always going to be the dumbest, like, denominator, right? And be limited by two or three COAs, right? We should always think like, hey, if they start losing during our COA and our COA is going really well, they will adapt somehow in mid-course, and should our plan be able to adapt to their adaptation, right?
Yeah, like it's an iterative process. And this is something I didn't appreciate last year when I was with Dr. Sterrett at CGSC and I was doing war game design and I was designing my own war game, right? Lifelong war gamer, first time actually, you know, making my own game. And he kept saying it over and over again, it's iterative. Where are you right now? And what do you want your war game to achieve? And through iterations, the war game gets better. And then we come to SAMS and we learn about planning and design just as a concept and this iterative sense making that has to happen. And then we don't have these iterations in the most important 96 hours of the plan, right? Which is the planning of the plan before execution, the execution orders.
Yeah, that kind of builds in too to the concept of, you're talking, Sebastian, about how wargaming too late often prohibits the yield on the value. And that iteration early on is about translating some of those, the science of war, into the framework for the world that you're going to war game. How do you reconcile kind of that task of taking complex systems and then bounding them into the system that you are going to engage in that bout of mental gymnastics within?
So as a game designer, it's always about scope and focus, right? The first thing we ask our sponsors at CNA when we design games for them, at whatever echelon, is what are the decisions that you want your players to wrestle with? That is at the core of it, right? It's not by domain. It's not by, you know what I mean, geographic bounding. Those are just helpful ways to help, you know, drive at the decision space, as we designers call it, right? Or what decisions do our players need to wrestle with? Is it a resource allocation element? It is a tactical thing. Is it, you know what I mean, a combination of? Is it a ethical policy one, right? What is the decisions that your players must wrestle with, right? And that's where you have to start off with, and because that is your destination, right? And if you're like, hey, I want to look at coronation, right, as the key function, because I am wargaming as a joint JTF staff, right? I want the JIFMIC, the JFAC, and JIFLIC, right? All coordinating, right? Then you're not focused on the tactical stuff, right? The tactical things are just demand signals. They're feedback loops, right? So how a brigade or a SAG does things, it is no longer in your decision space. That is just mere input to you coordinating information, right? Or resource allocating, right? So it's really about focus and scope, right? And that in terms of decision, right? And people often misinterpret that as like, I need to scope it to a domain or to do this, right? No, it is, what do your players need to wrestle with, right? What are the things that you as a commander or as a staff need to really hard, you know what I mean, hard focus on, right? And one thing to remember is like, and this is one of the things I feel like got mistranslated in the use of co-ed wargaming too, is like correlation of forces, like tables and all those standard things, right? People have misinterpreted them as like, this is the standard thing that happens when these two factors meet each other, right? But it's not, right? Like co-ed development and co-ed, you know what I mean, wargaming is hard and has to be done fast. So you're not going to have 6 months to do it, right? Unless you're writing an O plan, right? But for most staffs, you have to do it down and dirty. And those are supposed to be reference baselines, right? We have all sorts of like combat adjudication calculators, of what we call them, right? Or models and stuff. But we adapt them to each game and each decision space that we're referring to, because we want them to focus on certain elements, right? So, you know what I mean? I always tell, you know what I mean, planners, like, don't take correlation of forces tables as gospel, as much as like, this is where we need to begin, right? And maybe we go up or down and so forth as needed, right? Or simplify them even further, because that's not where we're focused on, or make them even more complicated, right? It's just really is like where is supposed to serve as a baseline starting point for where you need to go to make it easier on staff to do it iteratively and rapidly.
I'll try not to go too far into my pet project of CoFoams there, but we're in 100% agreeance. We decided in this last previous exercise to use a CoFoam that I created in my monograph, and it's basically a dialectic, right? And the idea is that the staff talks about the elements of combat power, it gets graded subjectively, and everybody knows where that grade came from, because we're just trying to get initial conditions and understand basic variables when you're in this war game. We were a division, right? Wargaming a division op. So you have a unique, I guess, venue in being at Georgetown University. You have students potentially with no military experience coming in, and you're teaching them wargaming. From our end here, there is like, let's call it, there's some, you know, rough skin about wargaming, right? Either people had staffs that did it very well, or they had staffs that didn't, and they come into SAMS, or they come into CGSC with their prejudices for or against wargaming. What do you see from the outside looking in on approaches to wargaming and wargaming as a method to create, you know, discussion and dialectic?
So I think that speaks to one of the first sort of rules of, you know, learning, right? There's this whole theory about how we learn as adults and as children, and one of them is like primacy. Is like your first experience with something has a primal element of how you engage with that topic. Whether it's like if you have a really bad math teacher, right, you tend to engage with math poorly, even if you're good at it later, right? It's just that it has that bad taste in your mouth, right? And this is also why we have recency bias and so forth, and that combines into different things. But the point about that is we need to have wargaming experiences early in the pipeline for officers and enlisted, right? So they're not random, right? Because not every war game will be good. Not every war game designer is good, right? And there is a vast mix of quality there, right? So you have to, as an institution, whether it's the army, as whether it's a command or a combatant command, right? It's like, hey, how do I introduce my planners, my officers, my senior enlisted, and so forth, to wargaming that is quality that I know, right? And then also increase their gaming literacy, right? A lot of times people have problems with games because they feel it is amateurish and there isn't thought to it, and it's at times oversimplifications, right? But the point is like, why are we simplifying, right? One of the things I've always learned about doing wargaming and PME is like, as a designer, is trying to explain and carving out time of why my game design works the way it does, whether that's Littoral Commander or for a game, and be like, hey, these dice represent 4 missiles, right? And we did aggregate like combat adjudication using salvo equations based on hues, right? And showing your homework, right, will say, hey, there is thought behind these things, right? And we're trying to represent simplifications of abstractions and so forth, but the engagement, the dynamic is there, and that's what you need to focus on, right? And if you want to argue 5%, 10% there, here, or there, fine, give me a Sharpie and we'll change this number, right? But that's not the point, right? The point is that there was a method and logic, like you're saying about Kofums and so forth, right? And showing that logic, or what we call design schema, that undercuts all the game system, dice rolling, card drawing elements of a game, and to have them be grounded in like, this is where it touches your research, your professional knowledge, and your expertise.
So that's a great point. I myself have kind of been a war game skeptic before joining this course, and Dan and Josh have dragged me through, sometimes willingly, sometimes unwillingly, their design as part of the monograph. But how do you talk to somebody who might be a war game skeptic to try to make more clear how the design provides value into that MDMP? I see a lot of similarities in the iterative process of design. And in the military, we have to deal a lot with people who are design skeptics. So I think that there's a link there, but I'm hoping that you can help me connect it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I engage with lots of skeptics because I feel like those are the people you need to spend the most time convincing about the utility and value of gaming. It is not, you don't convert to the converted already, right? So, I'm glad you're here and we can have that conversation. And for me, having been a squad leader myself, right, and having seen officers of various ranks, both in the civilian world and as a enlisted Marine, I always say like, hey, when do we, as military leaders, right, at any echelon, whether it's at the operational level, strategic level, or at the tactical level down at the squad, platoon, and company level, right, is when do we get to exercise our decision-making as leaders, right? When do we do it? It's not a rhetorical one. So, like, when in your career, or like Josh, Dan, and Kelsey, like, when is a time where you as a military leader like really got to dynamically like exercise your decision making against like an adversary that was like thinking and trying to like go against you? Josh.
I mean, the token answer that I will always fall back on is in the combat. Right? But that system is incredibly contained. I think about this a lot too. I think I probably spend more time than I need to thinking about it, right? So I've been a company commander, I've been a platoon leader, but the times that I felt beholden to when I was in charge of making the decision was when I was away and there was no means to ask for guidance, because the time delta between the necessity of the decision. It was like it was in front of you. You could see it. It was approaching you. So I will say on top of that, that I struggle with finding a like comparison in the latter parts of my career on when I was making decisions versus offering advice for others to make decisions.
All right. Anyone else want to share? Dan, Kelsey?
Yeah. It's kind of funny. Armor Bullock, when I was a second lieutenant, doing armor school stuff, very experimentative. And then all of a sudden, when you're up in, you know, Army South or the 94th Air Missile Defense Command, and you're in that refined air where there's not a lot of people who care about your mission, you have a lot of, it's contained, but you have more flexibility to get stuff done because there's not a script, right? Anytime I was in a division, if everything felt scripted or absolutely contained to where even if you were out there and there was some innovation, it was contained in this small bubble like Josh was talking about, right? Like we kind of bound it. There's not, I would offer there might not be an opportunity to be truly like creative while you're in uniform making decisions as a leader.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that all three of us automatically went to kind of tactical examples of when we felt that we were able to make decisions. We keyed in on key experiences, critical experiences at the company commander level, maybe the platoon level. I know for me, I was thinking back to my deployment to Afghanistan as a platoon leader and being far away from the company and the battalion, being able to make my own decisions as a construction engineer doing retrograde for U.S. forces there. But then when you said, you know, against an adversarial force, and I had to laugh in my head and think I probably shouldn't describe, you know, my former company commander or unit as an adversarial force, but
also pressure.
Yeah. What I think the value is putting us through uncomfortable intellectual processes at war games so that you can practice that decision-making under maybe a higher stress, but low consequence environment. I mean, we read all the time to learn from other people's experiences so that if we find ourselves in similar situations, we have a guide path for decision-making. And there's value in wargaming for that as well.
So the reason I say this and I ask those questions is, this is my usual pitch, right, to people who are skeptical about gaming, is that if you look at how we train leaders at any echelon in the military, the vast, vast, small, slim minority of that time that we spent training you, right, and educating you is actually experiential, right? And, like, I compare it to, we spend, if our goal is to produce top of the line world class musicians, right, of any instrument, right, it's as if the pipeline is predominantly teaching you music theory and music history, right? And then the first time you touch your instrument is like at Carnegie Mellon, right? And like at on bright lights on in combat for the real deal, and that's the first time you touch a piano, right? And that is bonkers to me, right? But that is essentially how our current, right? We'll teach you skills, right? But we won't teach you how to actually do those like dynamic work in an orchestra until it's performance day, right? It's when you're in deployment or whatever. And the few other times people often like refer to as like CPXs when you're as like a division or brigade staff or doing something like that, but of maybe that's what 2 weeks of your entire career of like 15 years, and maybe you have like maybe four of those, right? Like that is crazy to us, for us to think that those are the only times you guys get to intellectually flex your muscles, right, as leaders. And that baffled me as a sergeant, right? Because the first time I became a squad leader, I was like thrown into it. I had no idea. No one prepared me. I like luckily was able to muddle my way through it, right? And I can tell you all the missteps I made, right? But, right, the idea is, how do we prepare our leaders, right, at every echelon to be able to have those practices, right? Whether those are ethical decisions, whether those are tactical ones, right, because we tend to focus on those, right? Or even operational division ones, right? I think, you know, CPXs are great for honing staffs to work, to coordinate with each other, and be like, one of my favorite games, which I count CPXs as one, right, was doing a game when I was at RAND for African Lion, for Marfa Marfor Euraf, right? It was a coalition CPX with like British and African partners and Marine Corps staff, and it was 2.5 weeks, like literally 12-hour days, and they just acted like a staff, and we just threw various obstacles in front of them. We're like, we would give intel reports, like we had this like 800-page document, right, that we would just pull pages from that we prepared, like measles, and we injected them into different shops, right? One time there was this incident where like Ospreys got shot down. And they're and the three shot came over all angry over to me, and they're like, "Hey, why didn't you tell me there were manpads in this area? Like, you're like," and he was like, "We're grilling me about how it was unfair, and we set him up for failure." And I was like, "Hey, like, all right, Major, come on, follow me." And we walked over to the two shop where like they were like in this room, and they had like maps and all these things. I was like, "Hey, where are your last like 3 days of like intel reports that you got from White Cell?" And they showed it to him, and all three of them had man pads. They were just literally not moved two doors down to the three shop, right? And the Major there, he's like, "Okay, my bad," and then started to yell at the two shop. Well, I was like, "Well, you're yelling at them now, so I'm gonna leave," right? But that's sort of, those are the things that you get to also practice as a staff, right? Those are different than company commander decisions, right? It's about coordinating, converging, syncing, right? And how to work as a big, cumbersome machine that is a staff, right? And I think those are ways to exercise that intellectual muscle, right? As a planner, as a commander, as a leader. And we don't do that enough, right? Because, you know, I'll speak for myself, right? Like, I love reading books, right? But reading books are passive learning, right? It doesn't stick with you, right? When you're in we always make fun of the DoD and our leadership in general by saying, "Oh, you guys are fighting the last war," right? It's not because they're dumb, right? It's because it is the last recent, most powerful, vivid chapter in their memory as an officer or as a leader that they refer to, right? The analogy I always use is like your brain is like the book, is like a book, right? And there are well-worn pages, right? And pages that you sort of can dig to if you like think really hard about it, right? But in the moment when we make decisions, we always go to the well-worn page, right? And those are often vivid because they're emotional and because they are they're powerful because they're experiential.
This has been part one of our conversation about wargaming with Sebastian Bay. For part two, please join us again next episode, where Mr. Bay will be talking about integrating board games into your own organization and talking about incorporating moral, ethical, and diverse decision-making into board games as part of the design process. The views and expressions heard here are those of the authors and do not reflect the official position or opinion of SAMS, the U.S. Army, or the U.S. government. Stay up to date on all things SAMS by following us on Twitter at US_SAMS and on Instagram at US.SAMS. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe or to follow the podcast. Additionally, if you have recommendations for an episode or otherwise would like to engage with the team, feel free to email us at operationalarch@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.